will need to establish a free communal society that's not governed by the economic laws that govern capitalism. For instance, to succeed with capitalism, producers are forced to maximize production and minimize costs. And this is the main cause of inequality, poverty, unemployment, alienated labor, and all the rest. Efforts to create new social relationships without challenging this dynamic, either by ignoring it or doing things differently in the cracks of the system, can only go so far.
You criticize the fact that much of the left fails to make the struggle for a new society integral to the day-to-day struggles that it's involved in. Aren't we overcoming the separation between our ultimate goals and our immediate activity by acting as if we were already free?
No, we delude ourselves if we think that we can live as if we were free without actually being free. Freedom is not a state of mind. It is the condition in which people are not forced to work and live in a way that exploits humans and destroys nature. Right now, as long as the capitalist system exists, we all have to live within it. Capitalist relations affect and dominate every aspect of life.
Why can't we just opt out of the capitalist system and find some other way to survive?
The worldwide system of value production can't be changed by opting out of it. A few people can dumpster dive for food instead of working, but we can't all do so. If no one worked, where would tomorrow's leftovers come from? Nor can we escape the system. For example, if you individually hand-make shoes or form a cooperative, you still have to buy the materials and sell the shoes in an international market. Buyers want the shoes as cheaply as possible. How can you compete successfully against companies that produce similar shoes using exploited labor without driving down the cost of your shoes by exploiting yourself? The system must be uprooted and replaced with a wholly different way of working, not just distributing. And we need a system in which it's possible to produce for human needs, not for the sake of expanding abstract wealth, profit.
What do you mean by value production and capitalist exploitation?
Value is abstract wealth. Value production occurs when the purpose of production isn't just to produce concrete things, goods, and services, but to produce wealth in the abstract. The driving force of capitalism is the maximum expansion of abstract wealth, that is, maximum accumulation of capital. This is achieved by forcing people to work for a living and extracting the maximum possible labor from workers while paying them the minimum possible. That's exploitation. And because the goal is to expand abstract wealth without limit, it's capitalist exploitation. It's true that some people get rich off the backs of others as a result, but that's not what drives the system. Capitalist companies are forced to operate in this way in order to be competitive. So a focus on greedy capitalists loses sight of the underlying problem, the drive to expand abstract wealth without limit. We have to overcome this drive, and the economic laws that force capitalists to operate this way, in order to have a society in which we produce directly to satisfy human needs.
I'm skipping some more here.
Okay.
Let's do 10. Why do you say we need to understand how capitalism works? Isn't it sufficient to educate people on all the evil it does and tell them those evils are related and we need to get rid of the whole system?
Educating people about the effects of capitalism does not show how the effects are related. Why should they take our word for it? Nor does it give a whiff of how to get rid of the system because it doesn't identify the causes. If we don't know the causes, we don't know how to get rid of the effects. Understanding how capitalism functions is the beginning point for first, understanding why everyone can't just drop out of it, and second, figuring out what must be uprooted in order to create a different system of production and life.
What is unique about the philosophy of Marxist humanism? How does it differ from all of the philosophies espoused by other Marxists and anarchists?
This one's a bit long. The most important difference is that Marxist humanism rejects both the notion that working people are backward and therefore need to be led by a vanguard, and the notion that society can be revolutionized solely by means of a spontaneous activity from below. The creation of a new society requires not only the destruction of the old one, but the creation of totally new social relations. We won't automatically become free by getting the rich parasites, the state, and all the rest off our backs. We need to overcome the economic laws of capitalism and run economic and social life according to wholly different principles. Spontaneous activity by itself will not work out what these principles are or how they can be implemented. The success of the creative aspect of the revolutionary process requires sustained focus on these issues, ongoing philosophical and theoretical development, ongoing dialogue involving working people, intellectuals, and others, and organizations like Marxist Humanist Initiative that are committed to making sure that these issues do get worked out, not by ourselves alone by any means. Another unique aspect of Marxist humanism is that it holds that Marx had a unique humanist philosophy centered on the development of human capacities as an end in itself, rather than as a mere means to achieve external goals, such as the expansion of production. Our organization judges everything in light of this vision of humanity's possible future. It is the foundation of our own efforts to help work out new principles for social and economic life, as well as the foundation of our day-to-day political activity and commentary. We are trying to help forge a new unity of philosophy and organization in which mass movements strive for freedom, lay hold of Marxist philosophy of revolution, and recreate society on its basis.
I think we won't read the rest because of the time problems, but I urge you to do so because they're actually better than my talk is going to be. And we think they help overcome some of the language barriers that seem to exist when we talk to occupiers sometimes. Shall I go? Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to give a little talk and then Mike is too. I hope the FAQs are helpful in giving you some insight into how different Marxist humanism is, both from left vanguardism and from the supposedly opposite idea, opposite to vanguardism, that the new society is already here and we just have to make it explicit. Vanguardism is pretty discredited today in the form of left parties who claim only they can set the line, program, etc. for revolutionary activity. But vanguardism lives very strongly in prevailing left ideas, unfortunately, especially the common explicit or implicit idea that working people are, quote, backward and need their, quote, consciousness raised. We think it's the left who needs its understanding concerning the revolutionary process revamped. And the workers are doing fine. The other view, that the new society is already here in embryo and can simply be brought to the surface, is common among some anarchist strains and some Marxist ones. In MHA, we call that Johnsonism, after C.L.R. James, whose pen name was Johnson. He was a co-leader with Dostoevsky in the Johnson Force tendency of the 1940s and early 50s that preceded Dostoevsky's own organization, out of which we come. That's how old these ideas are, from the 40s and 50s. It's nothing new. In fact, the Italian autonomists of the 1970s, whose influence David Graeber acknowledges, got much of their concept of revolution from below, from Dostoevsky, back in the 40s, 50s. Unfortunately, these people who picked up on some of these ideas about new society did not develop the ideas in the same direction that Dostoevsky did. So I'll be talking mostly about Dostoevsky's ideas in contrast to David Graeber and the anarchists. Okay, C.L.R. James held that the new society was already present within the old, not as potential or prefiguration, but as here and now. Let's look at what's happening in the battle of ideas within and around Occupy Wall Street, specifically David Graeber's version of social transformation through creating communities that hollow out the state from within capitalism and by acting, quote, as if we were already free. That's his term. I don't know if you all read Kleinman's essay. That concept in Graeber, but there's copies if you didn't. It's on our website. Hyman's essay, The Make-Believe World of David Graeber, has produced a storm of denunciations of Kleiman on the internet. And although Graeber originally claimed that he was being misrepresented in Kleiman's critique, neither he nor his backers have produced any example of misrepresentation. Instead, they try to make an amalgam of the Zuccotti Park occupation and the Occupy movement as a whole, which Kleiman and MHI carefully do not do. We make a distinction and hold only Graeber responsible for his own words. Even if the rest of the movement does not subscribe to Graeber's theory, inasmuch as the original occupation sparked a movement in its name, we think it's important to examine the ideas behind Graeber's concept of reclaimed space and of hollowing out this state by setting up your alternatives right in your reclaimed space. And as we said at the beginning in the FAQs, that was a dismal failure because the occupation only survived for 2 months, and then only with the permission of the mayor, and it wasn't even on Wall Street, so it was not taking any space away from the capitalists. It was just a park that was not very busy, and nobody cared if they were there. We're just talking here, we're not talking about what the movement sparked and what other forms it took. We're talking about the question of occupying space as the way to change society. Kleiman quotes Graeber in a December interview for publication, and this is what Graeber said, and this is all in this little essay. Quote, "I find the word protest problematic. With protest, it sounds as though you've already lost," Graeber says. "It's as though it's part of a game where the sides recognize each other in fixed positions. It becomes like the Foucauldian disciplinary game where both sides sort of constitute each other. In that sense, Foucault was right. Resistance is almost required to have power, which is why I like the concept of direct action." Kleiman comments, "What Graeber chooses to ignore is the reason why the two sides constitute each other. The reason is that the one side has indeed already lost. Oppressors and the oppressed, exploiters and the exploited, capitalists and wage workers do constitute each other. As Marx put it in the manifesto of the Communist Party, quote, there can no longer be any wage labor when there is no longer any capital. But this isn't because workers freely choose to play a game as if they were sitting down in front of a monopoly board. Since they lack productive resources of their own, they must either become wage workers for capital or starve." Kleiman continues, "Why do they lack productive resources of their own? Because they've already lost." Lost the means of production. "This is an elemental fact, not a psychological attitude. The expropriation of independent peasants' land was what created the class of wage workers. And every day they produce wealth under conditions that ensure that the wealth does not belong to them. Every day they've already lost. The same goes for oppressed peoples and nations. Black people in this country already lost the moment they were captured and put on slave ships. And thus we had a situation in which masters and slaves constituted each other, but not because the slaves freely opted into any such game. The fact that we've already lost doesn't mean that we should give up. We may have lost the battle, but we haven't yet lost the war." Close quote. Now, as Graeber tells the story of the occupation of Zuccotti Park, and I heard him speak about it both in February and April, last word. It was largely his idea to turn the original plans, came with a call, the first call for Occupy Wall Street. The plan was for demonstrations at Wall Street, and Graeber and some others convinced people instead to near Wall Street. And Graeber claims that succeeded. Now, as we've said, no one doubts that it sparked a new movement of youth, but it did not succeed as an occupation, as liberated space from which to start building a new society from within this one. He claimed in his April 25 talk, and this is pretty much a quote, I think. I write pretty fast. He said, "We pretty much won technically until the wave of evictions," which is saying we won until we lost, right? They kept the occupation up for 2 months, and then they were evicted. Well, I don't think that's really building a new society within the old. Most interesting to me, he said, the eviction was followed by, quote, a couple months of recriminations. So apparently there was discussion, a lot of discussion privately among the non-leader leadership of Occupy Wall Street about what they had tried to do and what went wrong. But we never saw any public OWS meetings on the subject of the occupation. It was just, you know, it was gone, and many months later, other things began to be done, and it was declared to be stage two of the occupation without any consideration of what had happened to stage one. In fact, there were 5 months of low-volume demonstrations between November and the activity that occurred last week on May 1, when there were, for New York, mass demonstrations. Now, I have a lot of bones to pick with Occupy calling a, quote, general strike for May Day. It was a nice demonstration, nice fairs in the parks, but it was not a general strike. And nothing could be more elitist and vanguardist than calling a strike for the workers. Even one union or one industry cannot call a general strike. A general strike grows organically through the workers' own activity and organization. It brings production to a standstill and it threatens the state's control. What our May Day had last week was nice fairs and a demonstration of several thousand people, which resulted in a lot of arrests, and that, you know, made it of note, but it didn't make it necessarily a mass movement. So. OWS got the date of May 1st, aside from its long history as the Workers' Day, they got it, picked it up from the Immigrants' Rights Movement, which has demonstrated yearly since its massive demonstrations of 2006, when it did close down some the Los Angeles and some place in Arizona, I think, places in the Southwest in particular, where the Latino community came out and had a real May Day demonstration. Marxist Students Initiative did enjoy going to the, quote, free university on May 1, and we had good discussions at our book table there in Madison Square Park, just as we had had in Zuccotti Park, where people thanked us, actually, for bringing Marxist books to OWS, which I consider a very good turn of events. To continue with Graeber's talk 2 weeks ago, he blamed the decreased numbers at OWS events on a loss of liberal participants and on the increased police brutality, and claimed that what is new now is participation by the unions. I have no time, is that my problem? Okay, well, I'm going to have to skip what I wrote more about that and my I have a problem with OWS claiming that it's a line. compliance with unions, even good ones like TWU, renders it a class-based movement in spite of being made up of students and ex-students. All the established unions and bureaucracies that cooperate with bosses against the workers, in my opinion, and they long ago lost any revolutionary potential. So Graeber seems a bit naive if he says, you know, this is a new working class alliance of students and workers, and everything's going to be different now. Okay, let me get back to Marxist humanism. We're thinking of doing another round of FAQs, so I hope you'll tell us if these were useful to you in getting some grip on our philosophy. But I have a possible new one, which is, what did Raya Dunayevskaya, the founder of Marxist humanism, mean when she spoke of a two-way road between theory and practice? Her philosophy is based on her concept of an ongoing interrelationship, dialectic, between theory and practice. She first described this, quote, dual movement in correspondence with her co-leaders in the Johnson Force tendency in 1953. And there's a little reproduction of those 1953 letters in which she works out the Hegelian dialectic in terms of actual revolution. The dual movement, she articulated, consisted of movements from theory and from practice. The dialectic's drive for unity produces turning points in the revolutionary process. Quote, the movement from practice that is itself a form of theory was her phrase for drawing theory from the voices of the workers, African Americans, women, and youth, not just listening to them and not just reporting on them. Although she did that, and those of us in her organization did that. But drawing out the meaning of what these people were saying. Her concept of a movement from practice, articulated 60 years ago, has informed many anarchists and spontaneist ideas ever since. But too often, emphasis on the movements, quote, speaking for themselves, close quote, became an end in itself, truncating finding the meaning and its contribution to theory. The simultaneously needed movement from theory to practice, as she called the other one, was not separate. It was not leaders or intellectuals making up theory just in their heads or dictating to the masses. It was rather bringing Marx's philosophy of revolution to bear on the mass movements and sharing what you worked out philosophically with them in order to begin further development of ideas. If MHI talks a lot about developing theory, that's because the, quote, movement from theory has not received the same attention as the movement from practice. And we think that failure is holding back the development of ideas, but also of mass movements. I'm gonna skip this, but let me do my ending. Should we not discuss the facts and failures of not only OWS but of previous movements, since it seems as if every mass movement, you know, since the 1960s almost got to revolution and didn't, every movement since then has contributed a little, but then fallen out before it became a mass movement. Don't we need to evaluate this? Who is this absence of evaluation benefiting? Certainly not the rank and file of OWS or other movements. Why is doing theory so often ignored and even outright denigrated today? I think that's very important to discuss. It seems sometimes that if you have a distinct philosophy, instead of being solely an activist, you're called sectarian and all kinds of evil names and considered undesirable. But it's a very not only anti-intellectual attitude that we see throughout the left in the U.S., but I think very dangerous. I'd also like to pose the question, is it possible to develop theory in an ongoing collective, as Marxist Humanist Initiative claims to do, and you're all, and have copies of our principles and bylaws, and you'll see what we're trying to do. We don't know the answer yet. We're only a three-year-old organization, but we can certainly talk about what it might entail and what it might mean to develop theory collectively. We think it's essential not to rely on one person. It's bound to die. So let me, can I have one more minute?
One more.
But speaking of dying, I just want to, I've got to say this in case we don't have a meeting next month. 1 month from today will be the 25th anniversary of Donaevskaya's death, June 9, 1987. you all must go see this wonderful film that this young British art student made about Donaevskaya. It's showing right now at a gallery in Chinatown. And it's just wonderful. So I was helping him make it, and I got out some newspaper clippings of interviews of Donaevskaya from 1964, where she's referred to throughout these clippings as Trotsky's former secretary. Seems like a strange way now to keep identifying someone who was a philosopher herself. But, and Trotsky and the Russian Revolution seem like ancient history. But this was 1964, and it was just 25 years after Trotsky's death. So the same period of time it's been since Donaevskaya. And to some of us, the 25 years since her passing have been an anticlimax to our youth, when our lives were forged in the mass movements of the 60s and 70s, and we experienced great leaps in ideas through our association with the mass movements and with Donaevskaya. For the young people today, however, even if they haven't experienced real mass movements like the 1960s and 70s civil rights and anti-war movements or mass movements in other countries, they are now showing new interest in revolutionary activity and ideas, including in Donaevskaya's ideas, so perhaps new leaps can be made. Let us not, however, confuse the Occupy movement with a mass movement that's on the road to overthrowing the society or digging it out from within. My hope is that young people do not have to go through a long period of disillusionment due to failed and aborted movements before they seriously consider what Rosa Luxemburg called, quote, throwing your life on the scales of destiny, becoming a Marxist revolutionary. So I urge the youth to approach the present in a manner that is grounded in history and governed by the pull of future society. This means to consider carefully what is needed from you to actually contribute to transforming this world into a human and a natural one, and perhaps it's throwing your lot in with the Marxist Humanist Initiative. We'd love to have you. The end.
Okay, I'm going to read quickly in the interest of time and also because I'm a little bit nervous. The last meeting, we all sat in a circle, and so it's like, seems to be more in keeping with Occupy Wall Street, the spirit of it, I guess, as it is. I'm going to talk about three voices from Occupy Wall Street. These questions, I wish they were being posed to us or any other group or meeting in the FAQs, but they're not. So I'm going to look at a bit of what Occupy Wall Street, the people involved in the movement, have been writing and saying in conversations around the subject. The first and by far most prominent person, Marina Citrin, just published something recently in Dissent magazine spring 2012 issue called Horizontalism and the Occupy Movements. In the article, she argued against a guy who wrote, Mike Kazin, who wrote the Fall and Rise of the U.S. Populist Left. And so she argued with the notion that the way to determine if Occupy movements will be successful is if they, quote, if they articulate, quote, what a better country would look like and what it would take to get there. And she goes on, this, however, is the wrong way to evaluate Occupy movements. The intention of the thousands of assemblies taking place around the United States, as well as in Greece and Spain, where I've been most recently, is to open spaces for people to voice their concerns and desires, and to do so in a directly democratic way. These movements emerged in response to a growing crisis. And the growing crisis, as she says, is the heart of which is a lack of democracy. So keep that in your mind. She goes on, many within the Occupy movement believe that they have succeeded in important ways, in changing national and global political discourses, in making concrete changes in individual lives, in restoring power to social movements from below, and perhaps most important, in allowing people to feel that society and the world can be different and that their agency can make that happen. End quote. Now, is there anything she describes, whether it be expanding the limits of acceptable conversation, self-development of those in the movement, increased power of organized groups, and the spread of hope that this world can be actually transcended for another one, that hasn't been the feature of past instances of social upheaval where the masses were in motion? I doubt Citrin would argue this, that there is differences in those particular instances. So then we have to say that these beneficial outcomes are not necessarily tied to what is particular in the forms and features of Occupy. To use a cliche from the world of statistics, correlation does not imply causation. I do not mean to say that General Assemblies, direct democracy, and consensus cannot play a beneficial, perhaps even necessary, roles in the struggle against the old and the creation of something entirely new built on wholly human foundations. But what Citrin seems to be confusing is ends with means. Characterizing the problem of, quote, deepening and broadening assemblies and how to enhance participatory democracy in the process as she says, the question of the future, seems to miss the point which was made almost 140 years ago by the bearded guy that no one seems to want to refer to much. He said, right can never be higher than the economic structure of society and the cultural development conditioned by it. The last FAQ that we have, number 20 on your scorecard, puts the implications of this succinctly. Democratic decision-making processes cannot ensure that all people are actually in control of their lives. Citrin asserts that the point of reference, quote, the point of reference of the movements is not the state or politics conventionally defined. It's the focusing instead on people taking control of their own lives and expanding the democratic spaces in which they live and work. So cooperative enterprises, for example, like the one Rick Wolf champions, and which we've written about on NHI's website, where all the workers make their own decisions on how to share and reinvest the profits, are still operating in a context where their options are circumscribed by the pressures of competition and producing at the socially necessary average established outside of their control. It doesn't matter how many votes they take or who would like to get on stack to express themselves. When Margaret Thatcher infamously said there is no alternative, she wasn't talking about an alternative to representative democracy. She was referring to capitalism. Whether she was wrong or not is a true question for the future. It remains to be seen if Occupy will take this challenge seriously or think that simply fostering spaces where people can do their own thing, act as if you're already free, and respect each other's opinions enough to not hear them, to not hear difference. Will spontaneously lead to a deeper understanding of the problems that we face. Has anybody seen the Metro Occupied publication that was produced few weeks ago was handed out, Fulton Square, there was like 5,000 produced. This is one of the official publications of the Occupy Wall Street, including, you know, it includes Tidal, the Occupied Wall Street Journal, or a couple others. But this one is interesting for a lot of reasons, but one of them is this ad here. It says, "Tired, feeling depressed, you may be suffering the effects of the corporate state. Other symptoms may include anxiety, loss of identity, feelings of powerlessness, general unease about the future, incarceration, extreme self-consciousness, homelessness, hunger, and unemployment. Find your local Occupy movement to begin treatment now." So this ad was fortunate enough to be on a listserv that the designer of the ad spoke about what was going on and what went into making it. She wrote, "During the design phase, I created an ad about capitalism for the front page, which sparked quite a conversation, controversy really, within our newspaper group. The ad remained, but capitalism was replaced with corporate state. As someone adamantly declared that using capitalism was too strong, not accurate, and certainly not what regular people would be ready for." And she went on to say, "It seems to me that the more we have dedicated conversations, teach-ins, open discussions, think tank, etc., the more people will be apt to connect the dots on the many failures we are facing and how capitalism plays a direct role. The key is to have a non-threatening conversation with the public, which when you include such a loaded topic as capitalism becomes a challenge to everyone's MO. I would submit that capitalism is not such a loaded topic anymore. I mean, we're living in year 4 of a really deep economic crisis. Unemployment is high. People are realizing that the system is not delivering the goods and isn't working for nearly everybody. If that is what Occupy Wall Street has brought to the table, and it's not about occupying space and interlacing them, if we're talking more about the failures of capitalism, then why is it not okay to talk about capitalism?" Another conversation I heard on the internet, the audio recording of Platypus Group discussion that took place after May 1st, somebody took the floor and they talked about, they were clearly activists working, organizing within Occupy Wall Street, and he sort of took the floor to set the record straight and say, okay, we're talking about May 1st, but really we're on to Occupy 3.0 right now. It's evolving. It's becoming a structure where disparate groups interact with each other. They sort of use the skeletal structure of Occupy Wall Street to support each other's demonstrations. Even if that's not your biggest concern, you kind of go there because, you know, you get a it's not only solidarity, but you find out about what other people are fighting for, and you kind of use this lattice of Occupy Wall Street. It's a synergy within different groups. There's an education program. I'm just kind of listing what he was saying. An education program. You talk to each other, learn different concerns. He posed it as, it's not really direct action, it's almost indirect action. We're changing the world without having to become politicians. And in here he's sort of echoing Citrin and John Holloway and others. Take existing structures and plug in, fuse different groups together. The system will begin to hollow out, echoing Graeber. And he said, this is key, he said, it's not, I don't conceive of it as a question of reform or revolution, but almost like a revivalist movement. That we're going back in time and undoing the corporatized mistake. That we all disagree on how life should be. There's so many different voices in Occupy. But we all know what the problems are that we have to face. And this was something that was brought up in the last OWS meeting that we had, and something that sort of went viral where a guy held up a sign and it said, "Shit is fucked up and bullshit." Right? So that was that's the analysis. Shit is fucked up and bullshit. We might not have to know exactly what is wrong. We don't care because shit is fucked up and bullshit. Let's just change it. So we don't need to know what all the problems are we have to face. If we're going to get the life that we want to live, we could just sort of, you know, go out there and make it happen. So I'm going to get to inject an FAQ that wasn't read that I think is also important. Number 12, there you have. I'll just read the answer. We don't think that social movements should have to shoulder all the responsibility for working out the theoretical problems of the revolutionary process, or that they can shoulder all of the responsibility. A lot of sustained attention and hard labor is needed to really work these problems out. So, in addition to mass movements, we need people, working people, intellectuals, Occupy Wall Street activists, everyone, and organizations like MHI, whose contributions to the revolutionary process consists largely of sustained theoretical work and outside practical activities, solidarity movements, and everything. I can tell you this is what happens. They need to share ideas and knowledge with the larger movements and learn from them. This theoretical activity is needed now and is taking place now. So there aren't any stages in the process. It's not about what people are ready for. It's about exploring what actually we're facing here and now. MHI's goal is for mass movements that strive for freedom to lay hold of Marxist philosophy of revolution and recreate society on its basis. But we can't predict when or whether that will happen. It's crucial to discuss and explore the causes of our social problems, identify exactly what must be changed, all of what must be changed, in order to actually transcend capitalism. We can't just decide what we would like the new society to be like, implement our decisions, perhaps at the barrel of a gun, like some groups still think is going to happen, and assume that things will work out as we expect. Actions have unintended consequences, despite how big your social movement is. To avoid making decisions that will have disastrous consequences, a lot of hard theoretical labor is needed. That's it.
Okay. And at this point, we're going to take a 10-minute break and ask you to look at the literature, stretch your legs, talk to each other, and then we'll come back for the discussion.
Sign the mailing list if you haven't. You can take that and
it's now 8:10, we'll be back at 8:20.